also transferred. She was actually the originator of this transnational network of contraband that sustained our family. And so I'm not going to call my abuelita a criminal or my dad a criminal. I think there were people that were trying to sustain their families by any ways they could. And under like, you know, for example, they lived through an El Salvador that didn't just see the matanza and the genocide, but a poverty that in the Great Depression that made Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath look like a wine festival.
Finally, William Barr, the current Attorney General, the Attorney General under George H.W. Bush. We just have a minute, but as you wrap up, Roberto, what is his connection to this story?
William Barr, as Attorney General under the first Bush, redeployed FBI resources, and the greatest deployment of FBI resources up to that point, taking FBI agents who were fighting foreign, you know, looking at foreign threats, and started focusing them on gangs. And then he starts looking at MS-13 and other gangs right after the LA riots. You can see he was there in LA, and he started us on the path to eventually like militarizing the police that we have right now. And then he then also had the INS deport the gang problem to El Salvador, and then he exported the after the war U.S. style policing, and then I found out that military trainers from El Salvador actually came to train LAPD in counterinsurgency and other police forces. It's just when you start seeing the
you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is having a program proposal drive. From September 1st through the 14th, we'll be accepting applications for new programs. Submit a one-hour pilot episode along with your application for review and potential airplay. No radio experience is required. Basic audio editing skills preferred. Again, that's KBOO's program proposal drive from September 1st through the 14th. More information can be found online at kboo.fm.
Do you believe in the importance of community radio?
Of course I do.
Then show your support today by donating online at kboo.fm and help us meet our fall fundraising goal of $80,000. We can only get there through the support of people like you. So donate at kboo.fm or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Give a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member today. Thanks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, fires are causing devastation across much of Oregon. Two-thirds of Portland voters view Mayor Ted Wheeler unfavorably. And in national news, the White House will no longer screen international travelers entering the country for COVID-19. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 9th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. On Wednesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 125 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 28,471. Health officials also reported 8 new deaths in Oregon, bringing the state's death toll up to 494 people. AstraZeneca, one of the COVID-19 vaccine developers, halted its large-scale clinical trial after a patient experienced a, quote, severe adverse reaction that included inflammation of the spinal cord. This is the second time AstraZeneca has halted production of the vaccine due to these severe neurological side effects. It was reported today that President Trump acknowledged in February that he knew the virus was, quote, deadly and was playing down its risks. In response, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany today claimed that the president has, quote, never lied to the American public on COVID. Nationally, more than 6.3 million people in the United States have been infected with the novel coronavirus, and at least 190,000 people have died. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 27.6 million people in nearly every country. As of Wednesday afternoon, at least 898,000 people have died across the world. A recent poll shows that Mayor Ted Wheeler is viewed negatively by 63% of Portland voters. That means a scant 26% of voters view Wheeler favorably. The poll was paid for by Yes for Real Community Oversight of Police, a local political action committee, with results showing nearly two-thirds of the voting population doubting the mayor's job performance following more than 100 days of demonstrations and overt displays of police brutality. Wheeler has been the city's mayor since 2017, and in November will face Sarah Iannarone and write-in candidate Teresa Rayford in a runoff election after Wheeler failed to attract the 50% plus one votes necessary for re-election last May. Further data shows 76% of the pollsters support Black Lives Matter, with an overwhelming 92% of people polled supporting nonviolent protests and 67% supporting, quote, these protests. Voters were surveyed online and by phone between August 25th and August 30th, with results having a margin of error of plus or minus 4.9 percentage points. 435 voters were surveyed, and in addition to sagging morale towards Wheeler, results also show a majority supporting a November ballot measure to create a community-driven police oversight system. The Portland City Council voted unanimously in July to let voters decide in November whether to revamp the city's current police oversight system. Voter approval would see a commission formed by City Council, with a window of 18 months to iron out the details, emphasis on a new system independent of the city, and with more power given to community board members who are investigating police misconduct. With fires raging across Oregon, Governor Kate Brown yesterday declared a state of emergency, authorizing additional resources to battle the wildfires. The Federal Emergency Management Agency said today it had authorized federal funds to help fight three fires: the Holiday Farm Fire in Lane County, the Power Line Fire in Washington County, and the Echo Mountain Complex Fire in Lincoln County. The state's largest fires are in Marion County, where Santiam and Lion's Head fires burned through around 200,000 acres of wooded canyonlands. The state's largest fires are in Marion County, where the Santiam and Lion's Head fires have burned through around 200,000 acres of wooded canyon lands. As of last night, the Santiam fire had 0% containment, and the Lion's Head fire had 31%. Several of the communities along Highway 22 and the Santiam River Canyon have been evacuated, with more areas on alert. In Lane County, the Holiday Farm fire has burned more than 126,000 acres and has 0% containment. The fire has destroyed around 100 homes in the McKenzie River town of Blue River. With at least 10 fires being tracked in Clackamas County, most of the county is under some level of evacuation order. Evacuations have occurred throughout the county, from Estacada south to the Marion County border and along parts of the Clackamas River. The county's four major blazes have grown rapidly in the past 24 hours. All recreation and public access is currently off limits at Mount Hood as wildfires continue to burn around the mountain. The Mount Hood and Willamette National Forests announced forest-wide closures yesterday, which apply to all forms of recreation, including hiking, boating, and camping, all on forest lands. In Washington County, a trio of larger fires, the Power Line Fire near Hag Lake, an unnamed rural fire that's burned over 2,000 acres, and the five-alarm Chehalem Mountain Bald Peak Fire have caused evacuations and property damage. The Chehalem Mountain Fire is also in Yamhill County and has caused evacuations as well as concern for nearby Newburgh. The state's largest evacuations have been in Jackson County, where the Almeda Fire, which started near Ashland, caused evacuation orders for more than 80,000 residents of Medford, Talent, and Phoenix. Interstate 5 south of Medford was closed early Tuesday but reopened last night, except for the Phoenix and Talent exits. There are road closures throughout western Oregon, particularly in the Cascades. Fires are also being fought in Josephine, Coos, Lincoln, and Tillamook counties. Conditions are expected to improve, with the wind decreasing today and cooler temperatures beginning Friday, though no rain in the forecast. Doug Graff of the Oregon Department of Forestry said today, quote, "Thursday is really our turning point to go on the offensive, if you will. School districts in fire-affected areas are closed today, as well as Western Oregon University in Monmouth and Lane Community College in Eugene. Several state parks remain closed, including Silver Falls and the Detroit Lake Campground." With dry conditions and continuing winds causing unpredictable conditions, thousands remain on standby for evacuation orders, as fire crews report instances of blazes traveling dozens of miles within a few short hours. Protests against police brutality and systemic racism continued in Portland yesterday, and even though police didn't declare an unlawful assembly or a riot, they managed to physically assault and arrest multiple individuals. A group of about 100 people marched from the waterfront to the Justice Center and finally arrived near City Hall. Those demonstrating respected the call from the community to avoid setting fires due to current fire conditions in the state. Police bull-rushed and arrested people who were nonviolently exercising their First Amendment rights. After being apprehended and restrained on the ground, a police officer lifted one protester by his hair and maced him. During one particularly violent arrest, an individual who was restrained on the ground began having seizures and vomiting. Police refused to let any of the medics on the scene care for him, even ignoring requests to turn off their strobing police vehicle lights. That person was later taken away by an ambulance. Temperatures in the Columbia and Snake River basins threaten Pacific Northwest salmon runs. Experts say that dams create hot pools of water that could lead to mass die-offs. KBOO's Brian Oster brings us this story.
Salmon in the Columbia River Basin have been feeling the heat, and experts say it's pushing fish species to the brink of extinction. Brett Vandenhoevel, head of Columbia Riverkeeper, says temperatures in the Columbia this summer have been above 68 degrees, a critical threshold for cold water salmon that can lead to massive die-offs.
We had a spill of oil that killed 90% of a salmon run, people would be up in arms, but it's happening silently because hot water is flying under the radar.
Vandenhoevel says the dams in the basin are the main cause of warmer water. The Washington State Department of Ecology has notified federal managers that the dams are in violation of water quality standards for temperature. Jay Julius is a commercial fisherman and member of the Lummi Nation. He says high water temperatures have devastated salmon runs in the past. The fish are an important nutrition source for Northwest tribes as well, and Julius notes they have a deep meaning for Lummi Nation members.
We've been farmers of the rivers and farmers of the sea since, for us, the beginning of time. That's really who we are, and it's our identity. Culture's fish, and fish is culture.
Julius says the rivers were not created to be turned into lakes from the dams. He believes it's important to listen to the people indigenous to this region.
It doesn't take rocket science to figure out the solutions to fix the wrongs that we've done and that we've witnessed. I think we all need to come together and just use common sense.
Vandenhoevel adds the hot water is an urgent situation, especially on the Snake River.
Snake River sockeye are hanging on for dear life right now, and dam removal of the four lower Snake River dams is necessary to save that species from extinction.
But an Army Corps of Engineers environmental impact statement released this summer doesn't recommend removing four dams on the lower Snake River to help endangered fish species. For the KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Brian Oster.
New Hampshire and Rhode Island had primaries yesterday, and Georgia's Secretary of State announced an investigation into 1,000 instances of double voting. With those stories and more, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory. Yesterday, Rhode Island and New Hampshire had their primaries. In New Hampshire, a swing state, popular incumbents, Republican Governor Chris Sununu and Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen, both won easily. To challenge Shaheen, the former governor, Republicans chose Trump-backed Corky Messner, who moved to New Hampshire 2 years ago from Denver. But Democrats went the other way, voting for a moderate Democrat, Dan Feltes, over Bernie Sanders-backed Andrew Walensky to run against Governor Sununu. Elections are called when all the votes are counted or it's clear from exit polls and votes that one candidate will win, sometimes when one person is ahead by more than the remaining uncounted votes. Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose, a Republican, warned voters yesterday to be prepared for slower returns this November.
The unofficial results that we report on election night are just that, always have been, unofficial results. This year they may be a little bit more unofficial than usual because we know that we're going to see a record number of absentee ballots.
In Ohio, another swing state, absentee ballots must be postmarked by the day before Election Day, but can arrive up to 10 days later.
The numbers will change between election night and the final certification. That's not a sign of something nefarious happening. In fact, quite the contrary. It's the sign that the system is working the way it's supposed to.
LaRose has resisted President Trump's attempts to sow distrust in this year's elections and wants voters to report any disinformation to his office. Trump campaigned in Florida and North Carolina yesterday, returning to the Tar Heel state where last week he urged supporters to vote twice, a felony, once by mail and again at the polls. Georgia found 1,000 double votes in their primaries this year. It's unclear whether they were intentional. Yesterday, Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger announced an investigation.
Let me be clear. It is a felony to double vote in Georgia, and we prosecute. My office is dedicated working with counties to assure that it won't happen in November or in the future.
Today, former Vice President Joe Biden travels to Michigan, another battleground state, where Trump won by just 11,000 votes in 2016. The New York Times reported that Trump may be low on cash 60 days out from the election. His campaign has spent more than $800 million of the $1.1 billion they raised between the beginning of 2019 and July. He told reporters yesterday he'd spend his own money if need be. The Trump campaign recently pulled out of Arizona's airwaves, canceling all ads between now and October 7th, when the state begins early voting. Brendan Quinn with the Center for Responsive Politics says ad buys are an important indicator.
That's really when we're going to start seeing not only the candidates spending the bulk of their money, but spending the bulk of their money in places that they see as competitive, places they either think as their territory that could be slipping away from them, or in places they think are possible pickups.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. At 5:45, stick around. We're going to hear news from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, it's Right to Survive. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 65. Tomorrow we'll see sunny skies with a high of 96. Today in history, in 1934, poet, writer, and professor Sonia Sanchez was born. Sanchez was an influential part of the Black Arts Movement and the Civil Rights Movement. The quote of the day is from Sanchez, who wrote, quote, "The most fundamental truth to be told in any art form, as far as blacks are concerned, is that America is killing us." Marked the solemn anniversary of the Ipperwash crisis this past Labor Day weekend. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A First Nation in Ontario marked a solemn anniversary over the weekend. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, it's been a quarter of a century since the Ipperwash crisis and the death of a community member.
The crisis began on the Labor Day weekend of 1995. Members of the Chippewas, Kettle, and Stony Point First Nation occupied the Ipperwash Provincial Park. They were protesting against the seizure of reserve land by the Canadian government during the Second World War for a military base. That land was supposed to be returned after the war, but by 1990 it still had not been. They say the land included a sacred burial ground. So, for 2 days, protesters and police faced off, and during a confrontation, police opened fire on a group of protesters, killing Dudley George. Chief Jason Henry was 15 years old at the time and remembers his own encounter with a police officer.
He stepped out and he had an automatic rifle. He pointed at me and said, "You know, you're nothing but a worthless wagon burner. I should just pull the trigger."
First Nations chiefs want the Ontario government to reflect on the relationship with Native people on the 25th anniversary of Ipperwash. They say distrust still exists between their people and the authorities as a result of unaddressed inequalities. An inquiry into the deadly crisis highlighted concerns about how police handled the response. The judge found that the then Premier of Ontario, Mike Harris, and the federal government were responsible for George's death. In the latest development, the First Nation, at the end of August, was given new land, more than 110 acres, that was once part of Ipperwash Provincial Park. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Native organizers, elected officials, and members of the Native community took part in the Native Power Building Summit Tuesday. The virtual event explored advancing Native political leadership. Lori Wiaki, who's worked on Native vote issues for years in New Mexico, talked about how power is seen in many tribal communities.
We're taught to think about it in terms of, like, you know, get up early, pray, be strong, be respectful, be reverent. And that's what power is to an Indigenous person. You know, there were times when we'd been admonished, like, don't try to be just like the Western world and think about power only in that way. And we have argued that it's important to understand that, because as a people, we have been oppressed, we have been colonized, we have been, you know, forced into a way of life that wasn't the choice of our ancestors.
Wiaki says power in tribal communities is the people, including knowledge, culture, and resources. The summit also featured youth leaders who talked about building power in their communities at tribal, local, and national levels. Voting rights advocates filed a lawsuit Tuesday challenging an absentee ballot witness requirement in Alaska. The lawsuit filed by the Native American Rights Fund and other groups seeks to waive a provision of state law for the November election, which requires absentee voters to have a witness sign their ballot. The lawsuit claims that needlessly puts Alaskans at risk during the COVID-19 pandemic, especially those who live alone, are at higher risk for disease, or have to self-isolate. To vote under the requirement, they would have to interact with others or not cast a ballot. Native vote advocates point to COVID-19 hitting Native communities hard. They say the requirement could disenfranchise Native voters. The case was filed Tuesday in Anchorage Superior Court. Congress is launching an investigation following more than 24 deaths this year at Fort Hood, which includes 2 members of the Navajo Nation. Carlton Chi and Miguel Yazzie both died this summer while serving at the Army base in Texas. Navajo Nation Council leaders say they were briefed by military commanders Tuesday as Congress opened the investigation. Tribal leaders are calling for a thorough review and are asking for transparency for families and the tribe. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Nearly 20% of U.S. coronavirus cases between August 2nd and September 2nd can be traced to one event: the annual 10-day motorcycle rally in Sturgis, South Dakota. A report by German-based ESA Institute of Labor Economics tracked anonymous cell phone data from the rally and estimated the event spread of COVID-19 to at least 263,000 people, with estimated public health care costs of $12.2 billion. The 10-day super spreader event was attended by nearly 500,000, mostly unmasked people crowded together in outdoor bars. South Dakota had the country's third highest per capita in COVID-19 cases in August, while the vast majority of Sturgis attendees were from other states. Last month, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem spoke at the Republican National Convention, where she railed against COVID-19 prevention measures like social distancing and mask wearing. The South Dakota State Fair was this last weekend, with around 200,000 mostly unmasked people attending. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is rethinking some old sayings.
Last month's Sturgis Harley rally generated over 250,000 cases of COVID, and the vast majority of those sickened didn't even go to the party. As if the virus was following P.T. Varnum's advice to not worry about underestimating the intelligence of the American public. Maybe this is Trump's motto as well, or twisting FDR to think that he has nothing to fear but a population with nothing to fear, or that Bush standby, say something often enough and people will think it's true. And when in doubt, distract. Threaten to defund cities that won't accept federal intervention as California continues to burn, the sky turned red in Salem and other places yesterday. Blame it on the wind, on August being its usual dry self. Donnie will just go golfing. I thought the saying, sun's out, guns out, referred to biceps, and maybe the Patriot boys won't want to get their precious rifles wet, though with Halloween just a couple days before the election, what will trick-or-treat mean this year? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
The White House has ordered that the United States will no longer conduct enhanced COVID-19 screenings for travelers arriving on inbound international flights, according to an exclusive from Yahoo News. Since March, international flights to the U.S. have been funneled to 15 designated airports in an attempt to limit the spread of the virus. The screenings check travelers' temperatures and other symptoms and require important data that allow officials to contact trace in the event that a traveler does have the virus. All COVID-19 screenings and rerouting of flights to these designated airports are set to discontinue on Monday, September 14th. A recent spike in COVID-19 cases in the Dakotas shows that the virus is not only a big city problem. Mike Moen with the Public News Service has more on that story.
The Midwest has seen higher levels of COVID-19 activity in recent weeks, and that includes North and South Dakota. And health officials say all parts of the region need to be mindful of community spread. The Dakotas now top the nation for new coronavirus infections based on their 7-day averages per 100,000 people. Shelley Ten Naple of Community Healthcare Association of the Dakotas says that's a more important measuring tool than just the raw numbers for each county.
You see some of the more rural counties really being the hardest hit. And so I think that per population number is really important because it shows the true spread of the epidemic.
Naple says rural America needs to get past the mindset that only larger cities are affected by the virus, as was the case back in the spring. She says examining different metrics can better inform health agencies and residents about where surges are happening and how to best respond. With a spike in cases, Naples says her organization, which provides support to community health centers, has seen higher demand. That includes testing efforts, especially on the North Dakota side. She says there is a silver lining to the surge being seen in this part of the country.
We're later to have this emerging trend. And so we do have more tools in our toolbox around testing capacity and contact tracing.
However, leaders in some Midwestern states have been criticized for not issuing statewide mask mandates or other policies to help slow the spread of the virus. Governors in some of those states have said it should be left up to individuals to make the right choice. Although North Dakota's Doug Burgum has strongly encouraged face coverings and not to have the issue politicized despite not issuing an order. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
The Community Flood Watch Project is collecting resident reports of flooding in Jamaica Bay near Long Island, New York. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many of New York's coastal residents are plagued by flooding during storms and on sunny days.
There are certain times of the year associated with the new and full moons where it brings higher than normal high tides. And with that, those tides can bring flooding into communities.
Helen Chang is a former Coastal Resilience Extension Specialist with New York Sea Grant and with the Science and Resilience Institute. She says in the Jamaica Bay watershed,
it blocks access to the subway station that people need to get to work from day to day, even services sometimes. You know, the delivery of mail can get impacted by water on the streets.
Chang says tidal flooding is getting worse as sea levels rise, and it's important to know how people are affected. So as part of the Community Flood Watch Project, residents document and report flooding.
There's a lot of value in on-the-ground information and community data, right? Because they're living in these places and experiencing these events 24/7.
Chang says the data improves flood warnings and sea level rise predictions, and it helps city leaders understand how flooding affects people's lives. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Brian Oster, Jeffrey Wade, and Nat Moon. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Anthony Lizowitz, and Mike Mullen. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8 it's Juneteenth Radio, reporting on the latest stories happening in African American and Black society. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative reporting with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Between the Covers, a weekly show featuring interviews with authors from around the country. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures. And tomorrow, comics journalist Andy Warner recounts his experiences in Lebanon. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are sitting down with Dr. Juniper Simonis, scientist and founder of Dapper Stats, with over 15 years of experience in statistical, theoretical, and computational conservation biology. Dr. Simonis joins us to talk about their work amidst the recent protests in Portland. Juniper, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's really great to talk to you about this stuff, even though it's such a sad situation that we're in, and it's horrible for so many reasons, but I'm glad to be here and be able to talk to you and share information with your listeners.
First, can you tell us a little about the sort of work you normally do?
Yeah, so I have a background in ecology. I have my PhD from Cornell University in ecology and evolutionary biology. So my day-to-day life recently, up until sort of this recent foray into chemical weapons research, has been primarily doing data analysis and computational work, even though I do have a pretty solid history in field ecology and in particular aquatic ecology.
And how did you become interested in studying the chemical weapons being employed in Portland?
I, like many other people, got interested in what was going on because I was the recipient of chemical weapons in Portland. From the beginning, as a disabled person who has to navigate spaces with a service dog, I knew that there were risks of tear gas even the first day we went out to protest. And so we would often have to leave early so that we didn't get gassed. In other instances, I've been providing mutual aid, like first aid and snacks and firefighting stuff for folks. I noticed kind of the way in which these law enforcement agents are using the chemical weapons, including their distribution of them in sort of environmental space, not just targeting people, but sort of like where they're deploying these munitions, and then how they're managing them afterwards, right? And seeing them basically littering the ground with half-spent canisters full of toxic chemicals made me, as a an environmental friendly person, alarmed, but then made me as an ecologist incredibly alarmed, because I know how this kind of stuff can get into ecosystems and move through ecosystems, through a lot of sort of biological and chemical and geological processes that move, organic compounds like these kinds of compounds through the environment. And that really alarmed me, the degree to which basically hazardous waste was being spread across the city and just left to be, washed away into the river.
Last week, you documented finding intact munitions, pepper balls or something similar to that, at the Cottonwood yeah. Charter School in downtown Portland. Chemical agents have also been employed in the vicinity of hospitals like OHSU. Why should we be worried about that?
All of these chemical munitions, whether we're talking about quote-unquote safe smoke that's spelled like SAF, whether we're talking about hexachloroethane smoke, HC, whether we're talking about OC, which is like what we think of as pepper spray, or PAVA, which is basically the synthetic version of that, or whether we're talking about CS or any of these other chemicals, they all are hazardous waste, and distributing them in general in the public is a problem. Distributing them in the public, in particular, in close proximity to schools and hospitals is a horrible problem, as well as parks and the stormwater system. And so last week on Wednesday night, the protesters moved back to the ICE building on McAdam, right at Moody and Bancroft. And that was the first time they had been there since like the first day of protest. In this round. And in dispersing protesters from the area, the combination of Portland police and the federal government deployed hundreds, and I am being very literal here, hundreds of pepper balls, which are or powder balls, really, in the direct vicinity of the ICE rental property and the Cottonwood Charter School, which is right next door. I counted 171 impacts of powder balls on the ground, which indicate, that they didn't hit a target except the ground, between the ICE building and the Charter School and the curb on the north side of the street. I found another 137 from that curb all the way up to Gaines, and then a handful more up by OHSU. Up by OHSU, they were using CS gas canisters, which are also really horrible. But the pepper balls in particular, they loaded up very heavily the area of sort of the southern end of Moody, down near the ICE rental property. And that included munitions that went into the play area and into the school grounds of the Cottonwood Charter School. And these munitions are very, very dangerous. One of these pepper balls has enough active chemical to kill a toy breed dog, like a mini chihuahua, or a toy poodle or something. A 6-pound dog could die from eating one of these things. A larger dog would get very sick and might have permanent damage to their body. Them just like distributing these things in the environment where people are walking their dogs the next morning, or people are driving and biking through, they're leaving piles, literal piles of hazardous waste in the street and in the bike lanes. And anytime one of these balls gets run over and pop, it kicks up, or a powder pile gets run over, it kicks up this stuff into the air that we know is cancer producing and exacerbating agent. We know it's an asthma inducing and exacerbating agent, and we know it's a skin condition inducing and exacerbating agent. And yet ICE and PPV unloaded, or DHS and PPV unloaded an inordinate amount of pepper into the intersection of Moody and Bancroft, which is the intersection that everybody who's going to the hospital at OHSU goes through. I go to the hospital at OHSU all the time. I drive through that intersection on the way there. When I was finishing counting this stuff up in the morning, I was yelling at people to roll up their windows, because when they would drive through, they would hit a pile and they would get tear gas in their car on the way to the hospital the next morning, right? So like, this is a completely disregarding the public's health and well-being distribution of very hazardous waste throughout our environment. And this is from, again, just one night in southwestern Portland.
Ted Wheeler was recently endorsed by the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, an organization whose mission it is to back pro-environment candidates. Ted Wheeler is, of course, also the city's police commissioner. Do you agree with OLCV's endorsement of Wheeler as a pro-environment candidate?
No. I think it's laughable that anybody who fashions themselves as a conservation-minded voter would support an individual who has indiscriminately used hazardous waste as weaponry against the populace and the environment of the city for nearly 3 months without any personal accountability. I am not shocked given the history of OLCV, but it's sad anytime anybody who's a conservationist or fashions themselves as such endorses a massive polluter like Ted Wheeler. And let's be honest, because Ted Wheeler is the commissioner of the Portland Police, the buck stops with him when it comes to failure to acknowledge and take the legally required action for notification of DEQ and handling of hazardous waste. Like, this is a known set of laws, this is a known set of chemicals. None of this should be a surprise, and yet he's been doing this for 90 days with no accountability. To me, that is a person who's in a political space that does not have leadership skills when it comes to conservation.
I wanted to talk just briefly. Something I'm really interested in any radical movement is mutual aid and community that sort of props up the movement and also doesn't really get a lot of coverage. Is that something you could speak to in your experience during the past 88 or 89 days?
Totally. It was during the North Precinct protest that resulted in some fires where that moment really radicalized me around needing to provide mutual aid and how we needed to do it, or I needed to do it, because I was actually at the North Precinct dropping off supplies like snacks and water and stuff for folks when the fire happened. And I saw then and then later the combination of protesters moving things away from the fire and the combination of protesters trying to put out the fire on the building and the police shooting like quote unquote less lethal munitions at the protester trying to put out the fire so that they could have a picture of part of the building on fire. And when I saw that happening and I put two and two together about what they were actually doing there and how it got crafted into this narrative for the media, I realized that as the child and grandchild of firefighters, that I needed to step up with that role. And so it was at that point then that I started distributing fire extinguishers to folks. I'm carrying fire extinguisher all the time with me, and really kind of leaning heavily into, in addition to like the other kinds of mutual aid that I was providing, like snacks and water and, you know, sort of basic first aid and some field medic stuff, to also providing and focusing on fire extinguishing. Yeah, I see the importance of mutual aid. Like we are protecting each other. Everybody who is, you know, who's part of this movement, whether they're on the front lines or off the front lines, is contributing in support of a greater cause than themselves. And that is really important. And it manifests in a lot of different ways. It manifests in, you know, washing people's eyes out. Like the first time I was downtown during the during a Marshall's attack, I had to wash eyes out of like random civilians who were driving through downtown that just happened to get tear gassed in their car and had no idea what was going on. Right. And it's just like our mutual aid isn't limited to the people who are on the front lines protesting. We're supporting neighbors that are getting attacked as well. And those neighbors are supporting us. Like, I got tear gassed a couple of days ago and shot with impact munitions while just doing data collection. And, you know, this is near the Penumbra building where Multnomah County has their offices. And the sheriff has their offices. And, like, some neighbors there took amazing care of me. And, like, this mutual aid stuff, it's really important, but it's broader than just the folks that you see on the ground. There's a very large network supporting the folks that you see on the ground every night.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I think a lot of people don't realize the absolute sense of community that has grown from this movement. Thank you for sharing that. Before we wrap up, Juniper, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, so I definitely want always to call back to and center the reason why we're out on the streets right now, and that's because we're fighting for Black lives, and we're fighting against, in particular, police brutality and mistreatment of Black lives, and it's, you know, specifically George Floyd that really instigated this. But the reason why we're out there every night doing all these things and being tear gassed is because we are standing up to say that Black lives matter, and we're standing up with our Black neighbors and our community members to show support. And I want to make sure that gets centered in every single conversation I have, because yes, tear gas is important, but the really important thing here is that Ted Wheeler and Chad Wolf think Black lives are so unimportant that they're willing to use hazardous chemicals indiscriminately to show how unimportant they believe Black lives are. And every day, in response, people show up to say that Black lives matter, and that they're willing to put their lives and their bodies on the line in the face of chemical weapons to show that Black lives matter.
Juniper, thank you so much for speaking with us today. We really appreciate the work you're doing and look forward to following it closely in the months to come.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really great talking with you.
KBOO Community Radio wants to know what you care about this election season. We want to ask our listeners one simple question. What do you think candidates should be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know by filling out our Citizens Agenda survey, and you can be entered in